Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You know, I could always have a corporate career and made sure that I finished the charters and all those sorts of things, but I knew I would end up in entrepreneurship at some point. There was not a doubt in my mind. The advent of Float was this whole buy now, pay later craze was exploding. Was very excited about the prospects of this business model. But at the same time, the last thing South Africa needs is just more unsecured credit being piled on top. This isn't Australia. It isn't Sweden. So I did take that to heart, and looking into the buy now, pay later space, realized that in Latin America, point of sale interest-free installments have been there for ages. In those markets, it's done very much off the back of a credit card. And our view is that credit cards are the best cash flow tools available to consumers if used correctly. The point of Float is to help people to use it in the best way possible.
When I did my MBA back in 2007, it included an overseas trip. I went with a group going to the US to explore the startup scenes in Seattle, Palo Alto, and New York. At the midpoint of that adventure, we had the opportunity to meet with Guy Kawasaki, who we had known about from entrepreneurship and innovation lectures. I think The Art of the Start is still somewhere on my bookshelf. But in person, he is even more charismatic. So ever since, I've always kept an eye out for his books and his talks, and more recently, his podcast, Remarkable People. You'll find that wherever you're listening to this one. But even better news is that he's just released the Think Remarkable book. It's a distillation of the lessons learned from his incredible lineup of guests. I've just started listening to it, and already, as I was recording this episode, I've had a chance to see some of its lessons play out in real life. Order Guy's book, read it, and then think about Alex's early career in terms of developing your passion, not finding it, and in terms of Steve Jobs' Stanford commencement speech, and trusting that the dots you put down today will somehow connect in your future. Welcome to How to Lend Money to Strangers with Brendan LaGrange. Alex Forsyth Thompson, founder and CEO of Africa's most flexible, frictionless, and financially responsible installment payment platform, Float. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Brendan.
It's a pleasure. Alex, it's certainly not uncommon for someone with a Bachelor of Commerce degree, a CFA, and a diploma in financial planning to start their career in the slightly buttoned-up world of asset management or wealth management. But even early in your career at Alexander Forbes, there were clear signs that you were going to be doing things a bit differently to most. So let's start there. What did your early career path look like?
Yeah, I think, Brendan, like most youngsters, I just wanted to get a job, to get a foot in somewhere. Forbes was, you know, a great company to start at, a good brand name, great structures. So I was super lucky to just get a job, I felt, at the time. And the culture in the company was very much about corporate innovation, idea hubs, young leadership forums, all these sorts of things. So, you know, I was one of those overly keen youngsters that was putting in an idea every other week. Most of them were absolutely terrible, super naive and scrappy. But one or two got through, went through pitching processes, and a couple of the execs decided that, you know, the concept was decent enough to sponsor. And, you know, that was kind of the start of what I would call my entrepreneurship journey.
And credit to Alexander Forbes as well, because a lot of organizations will talk the talk, but clearly they actually walked the walk. I mean, you described yourself not just as the head of or the director of, but as the co-founder of the Stockfell Project.
Like you said, it's admirable of a corporate to stick their hand up and do it. But all of these big corporates come with what one would call the antibodies in the organization, you know, naturally risk averse, lots of red tape. That's why it's just so difficult to innovate in these companies, especially in a very old and traditional industry like pensions and asset management and insurance. You have to be young and naive and keen to plow headfirst into that and try it. And that's kind of what I was. It was a fantastic platform to learn and to, you know, try something bold and have the support of a balance sheet and all those things. So very grateful for that period. And it was very much then that I knew, you know, I could always have a corporate career and made sure that I finished the charters and all those sorts of things. But I knew I would end up in entrepreneurship at some point. There was not a doubt in my mind.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because a really thoughtful route to entrepreneurship. Was that something that you'd wanted right from the start, from when you were young? Or was that something you discovered in the early days of your career?
I suppose coming out of high school, I was always one of those kids. I couldn't fathom the idea of picking a career when you're 18. Like, it just makes no sense to me. I know there are kids who know they want to be a doctor or a lawyer.
Yeah.
But I hadn't the faintest idea, and the thought of being boxed in and that's what I am for my life still doesn't make sense to me, to be honest. My dad is an entrepreneur. He has his own business. So, you know, that was definitely one of the influences. But, you know, my philosophy was, I want to get a degree. I want to get a few years of work experience, build a base. And then, as I said, it was kind of fortuitous, the timing of where Forbes was in its own life cycle and where, you know, this whole corporate innovation trend was at, you know, that I arrived at that time. I can't say I went in and I had this massive plan and all these steps mapped out. There's no way. There was a little bit of haphazardness to it, but the opportunities were certainly there. And I guess I was one of those people that took them with both hands. So, you know, I left to start the Stockfell business within Alex Forbes. And, you know, we partnered with the Stockfell Association to roll out unit trust to Stockfells. And those are, in South Africa, informal savings clubs, generally considered to be unsophisticated, but not actually the case. And we were trying to give them access to asset management vehicles. But anyway, post that, got promoted to the group head of innovation, working under the CEO. And he was kind of like, do what you did there on a company-wide level. And my view was, I will never do that again inside a company. I will never try to build inside a corporate again. But what I am keen to do is look outside and see what's going on in the world of fintech and, you know, see who's building interesting things. We just need to be very focused on finding problem statements we want to solve for. So you're not just trying to pick an idea off the wall, because those are for free.
Yeah.
And I must say, super grateful for the likes of also Derek Msebi. He was very pivotal on that journey for me. And credit was particularly topical, as well as personal money management. And those were two things we wanted to solve for deeply. You know, a lot of these big asset managers are really great when you got money and you have excess disposable income, not so great when you don't. So that was really what we wanted to solve for. And, you know, where I started getting, you know, more into what was going on in the world of fintech and alternative lending and payments, and really just drank the Kool-Aid.
And from there, you moved through venture consulting to the ultimate fruition of all of this. At the end of 2020, you founded Float. Big shopping, small payments. What is Float? And having spent a career building up to this point, what was that reality like on sort of day one when you're standing there with the keys to your new business in your hand and it's actually a reality?
Just to rewind just a little bit, this whole buy now, pay later craze was exploding. I hadn't seen anything like it. Interest-free credit didn't really make sense to me and was very excited about the prospects of this business model. But at the same time, a lot of the people I spoke to in banking and lending were just like, the last thing South Africa needs is just more unsecured credit being piled on top. This isn't Australia. It isn't Sweden, where Klarna is from. So I did take that to heart. And looking into the buy now, pay later space, realized that in countries like Brazil, Mexico being two significant examples, point of sale interest-free installments have been there for ages,
yeah,
offered by most retailers. Yes, it's now become tech-enabled. But in those markets, it's done very much off the back of a credit card. And the bank is the key issuer of their credit. They understand the consumer and what they're earning. And the thesis was that the South African use case is far more similar to those markets, developing markets, high interest rates, very disparate levels of income. In some places, you'd argue over-indebtedness of the middle class. as opposed to a massive need for financial inclusion, which is the narrative.
Yeah.
And I just felt that that product would fit so well here. We just have to find a way to technically adapt it and create it here. So I left Forbes, the venture consulting. I worked with a bunch of accelerators and did some VC advisory work, which was also really cool, helped me to pay the bills. But all that time I'd left with the idea to found this business, and I was trying to fundraise, speaking to potential investors, and the consulting was really buying me the time and the means to raise the money I needed to start this business. And fast forward to the end of 2020, you know, I'd raised the money and we started building.
Yeah, and I guess that would have been COVID years as well, so not the easiest time to be out there networking and looking for funders and partners for. Yeah, what is a crazy idea, as you say, if you start at the position we were in South Africa with high interest rates, with high risk, and to look at that and to say, you know, well, what if we took away the cost aspect is a fundamentally different way of looking at the industry. And I imagine there would have been a lot of those investors having to think very carefully about it.
Look, I think that there were, and maybe still are, massive reservations about the BNPL model and whether it can work in high interest rate markets and those sort of things. But the float model itself, that's a fundamentally different proposition, because you're not doing consumer lending. You've got a technology cash flow tool for credit cards. So it is a fundamentally different proposition. To dive a bit deeper into that, the premise of BNPL is that there are better ways to lend. Credit cards are outdated. You know, these compound interest earning facilities are very outdated. The consumer shouldn't have to pay. So BNPL sort of issue a little line of credit at the point of sale with quite light checks for small amounts and offer short periods to repay and drive high repeat usage. Our thesis at Float and our mission is quite different. Our view is that credit cards are the best cash flow tools available to consumers if used correctly.
Yeah.
I don't think it's necessarily fair to just say they're evil and these horrible instruments. They're awesome. Like, if you know how to use a credit card properly and you understand it and use it to your advantage, it can make a massive difference to your cash flow and help you get hold of things you need or want that you otherwise couldn't have. And the point of Float is to help people to use it in the best way possible and to drive as much traffic onto the credit card as possible, you know, without putting people into a hole.
Seeing all the benefits of the front end, that is why, I don't know how many hundreds of millions of credit cards there are around the world, but it is a very good tool to use. We've always been scared of how expensive the debt is and often how inflexible, depending on the market you're in. And
yeah,
I think that's what's really interesting with your model. And I want to talk about it in a bit of depth. But first, just for those listening outside, if we could set the scene a bit.
The mainstay, especially of e-commerce shopping, is the credit card in terms of credit options. You know, many of the credit card holders are online and digitally native type customers. You also have your credit facilities that you can sign up for online. They are akin to your store accounts. Those can be very expensive. They've got your initiation fees, your monthly admin fees, and then your compound interest of north of 20%. So, you know, generally those are for people that don't have other facilities. And then you've got the, what we would call regular BNPL. There's a handful of players that have emerged from around 2018 onwards, 3-4 players doing the regular BNPL model. You know, get to check out, sign up for an account, put in your ID number, do a quick check on you, and then you're given 3 or 4 installments to pay. It generally averages 6 weeks with all of these players. Whether it's 3 installments, 4, the average is kind of 6 weeks, and it's for your everyday purchases, 1 to 2,000 rand, somewhere there. So super popular instruments, especially with, you know, the Gen Zs, younger type of audiences, or people, again, that don't have access to credit, quite easy to get hold of. And I think it is a great model. But if you miss a payment, you get whacked with the late fees, the penalty fees. I suppose the positive of that model is that you've got the privilege of paying interest-free. And if you behave well, you do pay interest-free. If you don't, or you abuse the system, you know, you get hit with the stick. And if you look at that on an APR basis, those late penalty fees are significant.
Yeah, in the end, it's necessary. And I do think that when you look at risk-based pricing, when you're charging up front and somebody pays the same rate all the way through, even though they fully pay their loan because you thought they were risky at the start,
yeah,
that's more unfair than when you give everybody free up front and the people that miss the payment bear the costs. there's still a bad history of how late fees have been used in the past, but someone's got to pay the money. And I think that that at least is better. But
yeah, I totally agree.
Let's talk about how Float's doing that, because I see card linked, no extra credit, no applications, no credit checks.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming it utilizes the existing credit limit in some way, but you also allow up to 24 months interest free, which is not very credit card like at all. So how do you actually make this work? What is happening when somebody uses Float to pay off a large purchase?
To give the elevator pitch, Float lets shoppers split their purchase into, as you said, up to 24 interest-free installments using any Visa, MasterCard credit card. The merchant configures Float to suit their business. So the merchant will decide how many installments are on offer, and that has commercial implications between them and us. Most merchants offer sort of 4 to 6 months. That's kind of the sweet spot that we see. The product is particularly useful for big ticket purchases. So not intended to replace everyday credit card swipes. The average order value we have is around 10 grand. So more meaningful purchases that guys would struggle to settle on the credit card and would probably either not have made the purchase or really kick the can on the purchase. So that's the value proposition to the retailer and to the shopper. And because there's always a catch, customer has to have the credit available on the card. So at the time of the purchase, we will make sure that the full purchase can be authorized on the card and that throughout the purchase, the outstanding balance is available on the card. And we deduct in installments from the card, almost like an interest-free budget facility.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
See, in South Africa, you know, it's an installment, comes with a lot of interest. In the Float case, there is no interest. And it just buys you time to settle your credit card in monthly installments.
Yeah, so in South Africa, traditionally, there was what we call the budget facility. In store, you could decide to use that portion of your card limit, 3, 6, or 12 months, I think, were the options. But it came at credit card interest rates. So a well-loved product and a feature used often, but at great expense. But then bigger purchases paid over a manageable period of time and at no cost. You know, it's a best-case scenario when we talk about consumer credit. With the added aspect here that you're not adding on to their exposure, you're not creating this new line of credit on the outside of the system that could, yeah, further in debt or over in debt a consumer. It's within this world, which is regulated and affordability checked. You're just using up a portion of it. I can see why it's really appealing to consumers. What's also really interesting for me is the role that the merchants play with this, because I started my career in credit cards, and we did have a team that looked after merchant acquisitions, but it may just be my own bias, and maybe it's a reflection of me being too narrow-minded at the time, but I don't remember merchant acquisition ever really being much of a conversation strategically. We were all about the consumer. How do we get more credit cards out there? How do we get better consumers? How do we make more margin?
Yeah.
And you are a merchant-facing business, isn't it? Like, it's the merchant you're helping out, the merchant you're negotiating with, the merchant that's your core channel. And you've seen a lot of success in terms of signing on brand. So
yeah.
Yeah, talk to me a little bit about that, like what that means practically in how you establish your business, but also how the consumer interacts with Float.
Yeah, the reason why the merchant is the primary customer is because when something's interest-free, someone's got to be paying for it, right?
Yeah.
So the fee has to be negotiated and agreed with the merchant. And for merchants to agree to a fee, they've got to see some benefit. They've got to know that the foot traffic will come to their store because they're offering this option, or people will be more likely to buy, or they'll load their baskets, you know, accelerate purchases they might have done piecemeal. The only way you could possibly get around that is plugging into some other network where a fee has already been agreed with the merchant and you working off the top of that. South Africa, it isn't really a thing. I know there's some interesting businesses doing it in the UK, but building that merchant network is critical. Second to that, your relationship with the merchant and that value contribution to the merchant, once demonstrated, is super important, because they are your biggest marketer. They are showing you next to the item, placing you at checkout, you know, showing you on a landing page on their site, because it helps them to drive conversions. And conversations we often have with the merchants are, is this not just going to cannibalize my existing card sales? And I mean, it would be very hard to argue zero cannibalization, but we've done a couple of case studies. There was almost no evidence of it. You know, normal credit card volumes remained in the same sort of proportion. But what you found was people who were hesitating, or maybe would have used another method, are going through with it now, or choosing it because they're going to make that big ticket purchase. And if that value proposition doesn't hold true, the whole model doesn't really have a right to exist.
Yeah, it's somewhat holding the mirror up to the credit card industry itself, who have had the opportunity for years to look at that budget facility. At the risk of repeating myself, you know, so in South Africa, you had your credit card, your credit limit was assigned to you. In the old days, it was split in half. That can vary, but the idea was that you could have your normal transactions, you pay in full every month. But we know once a year, there's a big expense you want to pay down over a period. So you could choose 3, 6, 12 months to do so, but at huge expense. And that product was around when I started 20 years ago. And that product is still pretty much the same now today. And there's a lot of cool tech obviously happening in the background to make it work. I don't want to belittle that side of things. And obviously a lot of negotiating. The little I know about merchant acquisition is that they used to complain a lot, because we were an American Express portfolio, about even the smallest increase in commission rate.
Yeah.
But you've obviously been able to communicate that value add better, and also add that value to the consumer better.
Yeah.
And some of that's the move, I guess, to e-commerce. But you're not only e-commerce. It's in-store or even post-store purchases that consumers can use this for.
Yeah, exactly. So primarily online, you know, that's the easiest starting point, easiest to integrate, you know, most smooth customer journey you can get. We are now in-store at hundreds of locations via primarily a QR code at the point of sale, and also have a payment link version of the product. So a lot of merchants stick us on an invoice. It might even be a QR code on the invoice. But the use cases span industries. So retail was the initial starting point. But at the end of the day, we found anything that is a big ticket credit card swipe, that's kind of where Float comes in. You know, that could be furnishing your living room, could be buying sports equipment. It could be the co-payment on a hospital bill, you know, that nasty thing you get whacked with when you come out of a procedure. It could be the repair on a car. It could be travel. We see our job, yes, being responsible and you know, helping to split the payments and helping merchants increase sales. But all of our traffic goes onto the credit card, all of it. Whereas, you know, most BNPLs, it's 80, 90% debit card. It's actively trying to displace the credit card. So, you know, our longer term vision is to be the infrastructure and the player that brings the banks into this BNPL game. So we're really excited about that future and working with the banks to more, you know, deeply embed the Float technology stack into the payment system. We think that's a super exciting prospect.
You know, when we look at why did it used to be so expensive, one of the arguments would have been, well, it's a risky clientele, or it's a risky segment. That's why we charge 20, 30, 40, 50% APR. You're charging zero APR, and obviously you're earning revenue from the merchant to cover the risk. But in terms of the reality of the risk, you've been doing this for a while now. What are you seeing in terms of how consumers manage the sort of BNPL? Is it being responsibly paid back, or do you see consumers treating it differently or misunderstanding the product?
For us, you know, because this is existing credit, and we're tapping into that credit facility, it is extremely, extremely low. It is not like normal unsecured lending at all. So we don't charge late fees or penalty fees or anything like that. The consumer will never, ever pay Float more than the purchase price. Obviously, the onus is on them to settle their card bill, right? We've helped them to break it up into installments and bought them the time to settle their card bill each month. If they never end up settling it, eventually their bank is going to end up charging them. You know, it's just bought them quite a lot of time. So Our risk levels are very low. The main things we're needing to subsidize in our charge to the merchants is the cost of processing the transaction. You've got your normal card processing fees. And for credit cards, those are a lot more expensive, as you'd know. And secondly, if the merchant chooses that option, we're using our balance sheet to fund the transaction. So we're settling that merchant. And if you're funding a six-month installment plan, that can become hefty.
Float.co.za is one easy place for people to go to see what you've been doing a bit closer and to learn a bit more. But you guys also put out a lot of really high quality content on the social media in terms of telling your story, but also in terms of the numbers you share. So if anybody does want to follow the Float story, does want to see what you're doing and watch as you grow, where should they be going online to do that and to stay in touch?
Yeah, so for the business audience and potential merchants, that sort of thing, LinkedIn is a great place. Go follow our page there. Float, you'll see the bright ruby floating balloon. Obviously, I'm on LinkedIn, so please connect with me if you want. And then our Instagram page is a little bit more fun, consumer focused, but you'll see all kinds of deals and our merchants and that sort of thing. And coming up soon will be a blog that we're launching on our website as well. So go subscribe there if you're keen to follow more. And we've got a very exciting funding announcement, which we'll be releasing in the next week or two, you know, with one of SA's big banks, which is super exciting. And that first step towards that end vision that I was talking about. So yeah, please follow along and engage with us.
Yeah, well, I'll put links to those in the show notes as well and to that story, because it'll be out before we are. But looking forward to see what you can do and how that sort of changes the landscape. Alex, Float was recognized as one of the top five startups in South Africa in the Visa Everywhere initiative. But I've also seen your name on all sorts of things on LinkedIn in various different people's formal and informal lists of startups to watch on the continent, which, yeah, must be a good feeling. But I also get the sense that you're not done yet. And in particular, as I looked at sort of the copy on your page and the webpage, where are you looking to take Float in the future? What is your focus for the near term?
We are a pretty level-headed team, small, lean team, and trying to build a profitable business at home in our backyard, first and foremost. So that is the focus, number one, is getting South Africa right. I think a lot of people underestimate the type of business and size of business you can actually build in this market. The TAM isn't what it is in the US or the UK, I agree, but you can build a business with good margins. You can be a bigger fish in a small pond and make a significant impact here. And that's very much what we intend to do. Next up could be some markets neighboring, could be some even further north. Credit cards, interestingly, are super nascent on the continent. So I think there's tons of upside. There may be markets where it might leapfrog and go to some sort of wallet-based credit solution. But I know that the card networks, part of their mission is to get card adoption increasing in Africa. We think tools like this will definitely help to do that. So yeah, on the roadmap for us, but I think we'll tackle that once we've got through step one.
Awesome to hear, and thanks for coming on to talk about that. Yeah, around the world, the BNPL models, the ones that survived, are being tweaked and adjusted. We know it's a segment that works for consumers. It hasn't always been done right in that rush to meet the VC growth targets. But now it is settling, and I think there's good lessons for people to take and maybe adjust their own course for the good of everyone in the ecosystem.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me, Brendan.
And thank you all for listening. Please do look for and follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and share the updates widely on LinkedIn. Plus, send me a connection request while you're there. This show is written and recorded by myself, Brendan LaGrange, in Brighton, England. Show music is by I Am Wake, and you can find show notes and written transcripts at www.howtolendmoneytostrangers.show. And I'll see you again next Thursday.